Atheism, Christianity, and the problem of mathematics. And this talk is to a number of different kinds of folks. First, there's the kinds of folks that when they hear problem of mathematics, they instantly translate it into the problem of evil. So what they've done is they absolutely hate math. They've done poorly in it. It is just something that they try to avoid like the plague. But then there's another kind of person that I'm also gearing this towards, and it's the people who absolutely love math, or at least aren't offended by it and can have some sort of acuity with it. So actually, it's the non-math people and the math people. And what's interesting, so that's everybody. So this is for everyone. And the thing about that is, what's interesting about this is that there's, what we'll be talking about today are things that just aren't covered and that neither kind of student gets. So the people who are really good at math, so what I'm going to do is I'm going to talk about some of the cultural implications of mathematics, some of the background of mathematics, and my main, really what this is kind of an apologetic for Christians taking mathematics seriously. Now, and what I mean by that, and hopefully this will become clearer as we go on, I don't mean that all Christians are going to go into a STEM discipline or do mathematics necessarily, because part of the point is that there's more to mathematics than merely doing the mathematics. Of course, there's the doing, and you can't ignore that, but there's a lot of this area of context and historical influence, and just thinking about how our culture, its personality, its intellectual personality, actually it's a split personality, as we'll see, that's been driven by mathematics, and that's something that oftentimes we just don't get a chance in our mathematics education to cover, and that's a shame. This is an advertisement for mathematics to say, look, it's not just about doing the recipes and following the formulas. In fact, as we'll see, and as I'll show rather than just tell you, that mathematics actually has driven philosophy since the beginning of philosophy, and our current cultural climate has largely been shaped by mathematical considerations. Okay, which seems kind of surprising because most of us think that mathematics is something, you can go through life, it seems like, and if you're a math teacher, you know that students are aware of this. It seems like you can go through life without really even worrying too much about mathematics. When are we going to use this? You know, that's kind of the standard argument against mathematics that students have. And I think there's something to that. I mean, it's obviously false, but there's also something to it that I want to make sure that we don't want to just dismiss it out of hand. Okay, so just to up front, we know mathematics is tough. We know it's something that a lot of people try to avoid. As I'll say a little bit later, even Dostoevsky in The Brothers Karamazov brings up in a central passage in The Brothers K, when he's talking about the problem of evil, he brings up mathematics as an analogy for the problem of evil. So we're all aware of that. I will say this, I'm not going to harp on this too much. I'm actually writing a calculus textbook that puts my money where my mouth is. But I think when it comes to mathematics, oftentimes what we do is we're driven by the textbooks that we're given, and we will teach too many concepts at too fast a pace. So kids just don't get to actually simmer and digest it, but there's a lot to cover. Now, I think one of the issues is to figure out and to take, to step back and say, all right, which are the concepts that are absolutely the most crucial? And other countries have done this. I mean, America tends to be one of the, America is one of those countries that teaches far more topics than any other country. And we're at the bottom of the list, or near the bottom of the list, for mathematical ability. At the same time, we're at the top of the list for self-confidence. So there is a problem with how we actually teach students to do mathematics, but that's not what I'm going to be talking about. So what I want to what I want us to understand, and part of this, whenever people who know me just get, they start seeing this after a while, especially my students, is that pretty much everything I talk has some sort of apologetic bent to it. I have an agenda, and it has to do with apologetics. And oftentimes the apologetics that I'm doing is not just for other folks, it's for myself as well. So you'll see, and so really what's driving this talk and the topics that we'll be covering today is being able to understand mathematics in a way that helps us do apologetics better. Now, of course, it's not just for that, because obviously understanding where our culture is and why it thinks the way it does, why it views science as so important, all of that is going to be part of the bigger picture. But I'm going to argue that it's largely due to mathematical considerations. Okay, so there's one of the things that I went through graduate work in philosophy, and my background is in science. I used to be an engineer. I went back to do philosophy. So I had this science math background. Then I went into philosophy, and it was interesting how a lot of philosophy avoids talking about mathematics. But as you start looking, as you start studying philosophy, you see, whoa, philosophy was actually some of the main themes in philosophy were actually arrived at because of, say, Plato's emphasis on mathematics. But that's often set aside, this was a philosophy of mathematics book published by Routledge. It's a textbook, academic textbook, by James Robert Brown. And he says this, he's saying something like this: if we taught philosophy today in a way that reflected its history, the current curriculum would be overwhelmed with the philosophy of mathematics. Anyone sincerely interested in philosophy must be interested in the nature of mathematics. And if you're, speaking of interest, go and see what he says right after that. Google it and find it's interesting. I decided to go ahead and not mention it in mixed company. So anyways, go Google that. So when it comes to the problem of mathematics, there's basically, I want to put it this way. The first problem, and probably and perhaps the main problem, and it applies to us all, whether we're atheists or Christians or whatever, we just don't have an idea of the centrality of mathematics to the history of the West, the intellectual history of the West, and how that's affected us culturally, including today's culture. But then there's also more specific problems that I have in mind. One is specific to Christians. And that problem, this is another problem with mathematics, is that mathematics is used as part of an argument, oftentimes, part of an argument against God's existence. And we'll see that by some of the top scientists today. And I'll give you a case study in a moment. So that there's a problem that we have to deal with when it comes to mathematics. And there's also a problem that atheists, that's peculiar to atheists, and they have to deal with, one of the issues that they have to deal with is the fact that the universe seems remarkably user-friendly. There's this strange way that mathematics shows up in the fabric of nature over and over and over again. And if mathematics is one of those paradigmatic, rational disciplines, there's this rationality that's in the fabric of the cosmos. And now if you're an atheist and you think that it just the universe is just here and it's just, you know, imagine you just drop a box of Legos, you know, it's not going to form automatically. I mean, you know this from experience, it's not going to form a Batmobile automatically. It's just that sort of the physics aren't such that it automatically seems to produce order. Yet the fabric of the cosmos, when you go deep enough, is really orderly and it's rationally ordered. So that seems to, so an atheist might, and I'm not saying that they can't do this, I don't think they can, but I'm not arguing that they can't at this point. They have to come up with an account to explain the applicability of mathematics. And we're going to touch on all three of these. So on the cultural, historical aspect, on the problem that we have as we deal with atheists attacking us through what turns out to just be mathematics, and the atheist's ability, or I would say inability, to account for the user-friendliness, the mathematically user-friendliness of the cosmos. So those are so when I talk about problems with mathematics, that's what I have in mind here. So here's what I'm going to do. I'm going to begin with, as I said, a case study of how atheists, some of the top, in this case, the top physicists of our day, have used current physics, which ends up being just mathematics, or almost primarily mathematics, to show what they think, that give good reasons that there is no God. Then I'm going to give, after that, what I'll do, that's just kind of a case study to show you, hey, look, this is an issue that we need to deal with. Then I want to show you, I'll run through, and this sounds overwhelming, but it's not going to be, especially at the height that we'll do this from 30,000 feet, the philosophical, historical terrain of mathematics. And I'll take some themes and just show how we get today, our current culture today, through mathematics. Now that sounds, here's something that I have to warn my students about this. I have to make this qualifier. I'm not the kind of guy who says, you know what, I love mathematics so much that I see it everywhere. You know, it's not like I'm a Rubik's Cube guy. I've never done a Rubik's Cube entirely. So it's not like I'm not that paradigmatic math teacher that just really, you know, that memorizes pi out to, you know, so many decimals. That's not my interest. Now, I like math and I think it's wonderful, but for the reasons that I'm about to give you. So I don't want you to think like, wow, this dude has a hammer and now everything looks like a nail. So of course he's gonna think that, you know, mathematics is just his thing, so he's gonna find it everywhere. That's not what I do. This I stumbled upon by accident, seeing how central mathematics was. I didn't look for this, and it's not necessarily, I'm not like super happy about it either. You know, neither way, it's just, that's just what it is. So, but I'm gonna show you how it's central to Western history. Then if I have a chance, what I wanna do is look at the three big issues in math. When we're thinking about mathematics, there's three big issues. One of them is going to have to do with epistemology, or the study of what we know, how we know things. The other is going to have to do with metaphysics or ontology, namely, like, what sorts of things are there in the universe, or what sorts of things are there anywhere? What is reality made up of? What's the furniture of reality? So epistemology, ontology, or metaphysics, and then the applicability of mathematics. So there's epistemology, ontology, and applicability. And I'll be talking about those things at the very end. All right, so let's start with this case study. Now, there's all different kinds of ways you can categorize and approach apologetics. One way is to look at it in terms of offense and defense. So, let's look at it from kind of a defensive stance. So there are these objections that are leveled, these attacks that come from atheism, that attack Christianity. And I'll say that there's three main objections to not just Christianity, but to belief in God in general. So the first one is just that belief in God is irrational. And it's irrational because there's no evidence for it. Second, science has shown that God doesn't exist. So that's another objection. That's another claim that atheists will make. And then third, the evil and suffering have shown that God doesn't exist. And that's basically the problem of evil. Now, I want to say, just as an aside, again, just to make sure that we understand, when I talk about apologetics, I do primarily have unbelievers in mind, but I want us to remember, too, that there's always an unbeliever in our hearts. There's always, on this side of glory, you're going to be able to come up with your own doubts, your own objections, your own concerns. Some of us more than others. Some of us just have that skeptical temperament, and we're going to be very, very good at generating objections. So I don't want us to think, you know, when we're talking about atheists, I don't want us to go, you know what, there's an obvious sense where it's us, them, but there's also an obvious sense where, you know, we're all damaged goods and apologetics applies to us all. Okay. All right. So now this case study is going to be it's going to fall under the objection that science shows that God doesn't exist. Now, I thought we were here talking about mathematics. And now I've gone to science. You know, now I'm saying, here's why. And we'll hopefully get into this more. But when it comes to science, it almost... Now, this is somewhat controversial, but it almost always boils down to the laws of physics, the laws that the universe is governed by. Now, that doesn't mean I'm not saying that chemistry can necessarily be reduced to physics or that biology can, but I am saying that ultimately the stuff out of which chemistry and biology, all of those organisms and compounds and all of that, they're made up of the fundamental particles of the cosmos, which is what physics studies. And we'll see this as we get into this notion of fine-tuning, where the universe came from and what, you know, why are the laws like this, that the reason that our universe is bio-friendly, that there can be organisms like us here, is because the laws of physics are the way they are. So what I'm saying is that the laws of physics, because they describe the most fundamental particles and aspects of the universe, they're really the most fundamental. But now the one thing that we're going to see this, physics as we know it is mathematical. In fact, you can't even describe some of the things that we want to describe, well, actually, most of the things that we want to describe in physics without mathematics. It's just you can't do it. It's like there's something there, at least for beings like us, and it may just be for any sort of beings, you can't say what you need to say about the cosmos without the language of mathematics, which tells us something fundamental about the cosmos. All of that to say, when we talk about science, and we talk about physics saying this, that, or the other thing, or the fact that let's say that the claims of atheists or unbelievers or whoever that say, you know, we've evolved. All of that is going, and especially if you believe in unguided evolution, that there's no God at all, and it's an atheistic universe, and you just have all this chance. You know, and then we end up with, well, you. that's still fundamentally going to depend upon physics and mathematics. Okay, so that's why we're talking about physics. Now, the claim that science has shown that God doesn't exist goes all the way back to the scientific revolution. In fact, that's where it really got its start. There aren't really specific dates for the scientific revolution. Think of it in the 1600s, roughly. But you can actually maybe bookend it with Copernicus, let's say his publication of On the Revolution of the Celestial Spheres in 1543. And then the ending, you might say, all right, 1727, when Newton dies. Those are pretty good bookends for the scientific revolution. But anyway, just think of it as roughly the 1600s. That's where most of the action occurred. But since the scientific revolution, since that time, and we'll look at this a little later, we'll see that there seems to be much less need to talk about a creator when it comes to the cosmos. Now I think that's wrong, and you don't, but there's this perception that because ever since the scientific revolution that we don't need God, that somehow the development of modern science has eliminated the need for God as at least an explainer of how the universe got here and why it's the way it is. All right, so let's go with physicists. We'll start at the top of the food chain. We'll look at Stephen Hawking. I mean, at least he's the most famous living physicist. He's probably the most famous physicist of the past generation or two. He wrote a book with another gentleman, Leonard Mlodinow, called The Grand Design. Now you might think, wow, design, he's gonna be talking about design. Well, he's actually not at all going to be talking about design. He's gonna use the word design in a way that precludes the need for a designer. But anyways, he starts out the book and says, all right, philosophy has tried to answer life's big questions. And he has three questions in mind. Why is there something rather than nothing? Which sounds like this is one of the questions that can give philosophers a bad rap. It's like, are you serious? People actually ask that question, why is there something rather than nothing? But in fact, that the Bible starts with this question. So don't knock it. It's an important question. Why is there something rather than absolutely nothing? There's got to be, I mean, it seems like there has to be a reason. You can imagine, you know, the cosmos. Why is the cosmos here? It seems like you might not need the cosmos might not be here. Okay, so why is there something rather than nothing? And that's considered to be probably the toughest nut to crack for philosophy. And it's one traditionally that has given atheists the hardest time. So if they can come up with an answer to that, they're golden. All right, so then the second question, why do we exist? So not just why is the cosmos here, why are there organisms like you? Do you have any, and this goes to the meaning of life, do you have any purpose? You know, if you need to know why you're here, you know, why are you even sitting here? I mean, like, why are you doing the things that you're doing? Are you just on autopilot? Is there a reason? Well, in order to answer those questions, you need to know, well, why are we here? Is it just dumb luck? Well, it'd be nice to know that. Maybe it wouldn't be so nice to know that. But that's an important question. So why is there something rather than nothing? Why do we exist? And then the third question that Hawking asks and thinks is the big three philosophical questions is, why this particular set of laws of this universe? Why this particular set of laws rather than some other set? That's going to be pretty important. If you had a different set of laws, you would have a different kind of universe, and in fact, you might not get you if that's all there is to the universe. So now these are some of the big questions. And Hawking says, look, philosophy's done a terrible job asking these, or answering these questions. It's like done a great job asking them. But now, taking the mantle of truth, taking the torchbearer of genuine knowledge now is no longer philosophy, but it's science. And so it's going to be, science can now give us the answers to these questions. In particular, physics can give us the answer to these questions, because the physics can give us answers to how the origins of everything. So actually, let me give you a quotation from it. Hawking says this: traditionally, these questions are for philosophy, but philosophy is dead. Philosophy is not kept up with modern developments in science, particularly physics. Scientists have become the bearers of the torch of discovery in our quest for knowledge. Okay, so that's the big claim. Now here's the answer. I mean, I'll cash this out, but the answer is, what he does is he takes the latest scientific theory called M theory, the latest theory of physics called M theory. It's actually an even more advanced version of string theory. But M theory is this theory of everything. Now, what I need to do is I need to give you a little bit of background, because just saying that doesn't put it into context. So we're going to talk about the history of physics in 3 minutes. Okay, so what we have, the beginning of mathematical physics was Newton's, basically came out in Newton's Principia Mathematica. So he developed Newtonian physics. He wouldn't have called it that. But what ends up becoming Newtonian physics, and that's mostly the physics that we learn today, at least undergraduates, and at least in high school, that's going to be Newtonian physics that we learn by and large. And that ends up being, that's the physics that rules until the 20th century. In the 20th century, Newton's physics is overthrown in another revolution, in a revolution of modern physics. And you have Newtonian physics being replaced with two theories. One is quantum theory, which is the theory of the very small, like subatomic particles, let's say. Then you have the second theory, is relativity, Einstein's relativity, which is the theory of the very fast and the very large, roughly. And let me emphasize the word roughly. So we have these two physical theories, relativity and quantum mechanics. And that lasts us for the 20th century. But those two don't go together always. Where there's some overlap, there's also sometimes some contradiction. And you can't have a contradiction. Well, we're going to assume that you can't have a contradiction, because once you admit that you can, then you can, and then you can't, and then all arguments are off. All bets are off. So we have to, we'll assume that there's the law of non-contradiction, that's valid. That's true. Okay, so in about the mid-80s, roughly, scientists started to look for a new theory, a theory that would replace these two theories. And the main candidate for that has become string theory. And there's actually a group, there's multiple string theories. And then M theory, which is the theory that Hawking is talking about, is kind of, and in fact, no one knows what the M stands for. The M was, it could be membrane, it could be the mother of all theories, the mother of all string theories. It was deliberately kept vague at the time it was introduced. So you have this M theory, which is kind of an umbrella theory for kinds of string theories. Now, string theory currently, string theories, including M theory, there aren't, physicists tell us, there's no empirical evidence for the truth of string theories. And one of the controversies surrounding string theory is that it's purely mathematical. And so it's so mathematical that it might not even be able to tell us anything about the empirical world, the physical universe. So that's something tricky. We're gonna set that aside, but the bottom line here is that these are highly mathematical. There's not an empirical bit to them yet, for roughly. So these are very, very sophisticated mathematical theories. And this is what Hawking is going to be referring to when he says that we don't need philosophy and to tell us to answer these questions, nor do once we get the answers, do we need God. Okay, so here it is, this grand unification of everything, the ultimate question of life, the universe, and everything. This is what he says. This is answering, here's the answer. In case you wanted to know, this should go viral, by the way, because I'm about to answer the ultimate question of life, the universe, and everything, according to Stephen Hawking. Here's the answer. We'll call it, quote unquote, the answer, and it's more of a paragraph. But what would you expect? These are big issues. So he says this, according to M theory, our universe is not the only universe. Instead, M theory predicts that a great many universes were created out of nothing. Their creation does not require the intervention of some supernatural being or God. Rather, these multiple universes arise naturally from physical law. They're a prediction of science. Each universe has many possible histories and many possible states at later times, that is, at times like the present, long after their creation. Most of these states will be quite unlike the universe we observe and quite unsuitable for the existence of any form of life. Those would be the user-unfriendly universes. Only a very few of these universes would allow creatures like us to exist. Thus, our presence selects out from this vast array only those universes that are compatible with our existence. Although we are puny and insignificant on the scale of the cosmos, this makes us, in a sense, the lords of creation. Okay, there's a lot going on in that paragraph, and I'm not going to unpack it all. I actually do this, I'll make this shameless plug in my latest book, How to Be an Atheist. I talk about some of the philosophy that's going on here and how it's really misguided and how ironic it is that by saying that philosophy is dead, Hawking goes on to spend an entire book doing philosophy. So see that book for more details. But I do want to say a little bit about this answer so that we can see how, this is a very, very powerful answer because it's being adopted by a lot of unbelievers. I mean, it's kind of like the theory of evolution. Once you have that as an option, that's the only game in town for atheists, so you grab onto it, and you're going to hold on to the only option that you have. This multiverse, they're going to call it, these multiple universes are going to be something very similar. Right now, it's the only game in town to account for the way the world is like it is. So you're going to hold on to it. It's precious. Okay, first the what. What sorts of things exist? Well, he's saying, first of all, why is there something rather than nothing? The something that he's talking about is kind of surprising. It's not just one universe. It's many, many, many universes. In fact, it could be as high as 10 to the 500, 10 to the power of 500. That's 10 to the 500 zero, yeah, to 500 zeros, that's 10 times itself 500 times. That's an enormous number. I mean, we can't, it's not even something, I mean, we kind of think, yeah, I kind of get it, that's a big number. No, we really don't. I mean, that's actually, there's the 10 to the 500, that's more than the number of atoms in the known universe. So that's that many universes perhaps bouncing around. Or it could be even more than that. But anyways, there's a lot of universes. It's not just our own. So that's the first thing. What is there? Maybe 10 to the 500 different universes. Okay, well, how do we know that? Well, he says the math tells us this. M-theory, which is a mathematical theory, you can, even if it's not, you can't read it off, you know, it takes some work, but one of the things that's consistent with this M-theory is that there are multiple universes. And all of them, perhaps, could have entirely different sets of physical laws. All right, so that's gonna do a lot of work. So you think about, well, why is the universe, well, first of all, how did the universe get here? Well, he says it came out of nothing. Actually, he says quantum fluctuations give us that, but there's a lot of philosophical issues here, and I'm not gonna go into them, but basically we get, the math tells us we get creation ex nihilo, without a God, because the physics tells us we do. Okay, so that's a pretty important. I mean, that's astonishingly important. It's the source of where our universe. The source of our universe. But then there's another thing that needs some explaining. You. Why are there these organisms that are so highly complex? I mean, and the more we learn about you, the more amazing we find that you are. What are the odds that we're going to get a universe that comes up with the laws that first allow the right kinds of atoms, forming the right kinds of molecules, forming the right kinds of objects, like, you know, that can coalesce into stars and then make more material out of which you can be formed. And then all of these things have to come together just right. And there's this notion that was called the fine-tuning of the universe. Where there are all these little constants that have to be just so. If they were off, one of them was just off a tiny bit, there would be absolutely no humans. There would be no, well, I shouldn't say that. I mean, there definitely wouldn't be humans. There would be no life at all. Okay, so it seems like the universe is finely tuned for biological organisms. Okay, and that's the physical laws. Remember the laws of physics. So when we're talking about, so you can see how physics really is fundamental in a certain sense. And because mathematics is the language of physics, you can see why it's important to understand, first of all, the significance of mathematics. Look what people are telling us, and they're doing so. Who's the messenger? Mathematics. So you have these amazing odds. Well, here's how to tame those odds. Imagine this. Imagine I had 6 dice. And I say, you know what? Let's play a little game. Here's the game. You roll these dice, and you have to get all ones. And if you don't get all ones, you die. Now, painlessly and instantly, it's not that cruel of a game. You roll the dice. If it doesn't come up, there's 6 dice. if they don't come up all, did I say ones? Ones. You're instantly gone. You roll the dice. And you're there standing there and you're looking at them and they're all ones. What do you think? Are you lucky? I mean, that would seem like something's going on there. Something's fishy. The Lord wants you to live. You know, I mean, it's pretty clear that, I mean, you would at least have questions. You would have something that you need to explain. Well, notice six dice coming up all ones. That's nothing. That's nothing. I mean, it was something in that case because it was your life. But that's not a complicated system. So imagine, though, that it's just so vastly more complicated, and here you are. Well, how would you, what if I told you, all right, going back to the scenario, you don't have to just roll it once. I'm going to give you 100 rolls. So just once out of those 100 rolls it has to be. I mean, you'd probably be a little less stressed. But if I said, you know what, you have the next year to just keep rolling dice, rolling them. And at some point, I mean, 24/7. As long as one of those comes up, all ones, you're fine. Then you'd be like, okay, well now I say, and what about a million years? You get to do that. You'd be even more, I mean, forget about the technicalities that you'll never live that long, but just this is something that as the rolls go up, your stress goes down. Your surprise would, you know, that you would be living would go way down. You're like, well, I had just that many rolls. Well, this is how the multiverse works. It's just basically you have all these dice, which are universe, and they're all rolled. You have 10 to the 500, and they're all rolled at once, and you just one of them has to end up being conducive to life. And once you have 10 to the 500 or even more, as long as it's possible, it seems like you might almost, you'd be pretty likely to get it. So that's how you get, so notice there's multiple universes, they all have different laws perhaps, and that really lower or increases your chance of getting a bio-friendly cosmos. That's the answer. And the answer, that answer is given to us by M theory, which is a mathematical theory. All right. So one last thing. So that's the, let me also say that's Stephen Hawking. Okay, there's another great, very good physicist, Lawrence Krauss, who just he just wrote a book within the last few years called A Universe from Nothing. And he pretty much argues the same thing. He doesn't use M theory, he uses something relativistic, quantum theory, which is supposed to include gravity. Anyways, it's not necessarily a theory that has all the bugs worked out. But again, it's mathematical and it's a different answer. I mean, it's a different kind of mathematics, presumably, at least a little bit different than string theory and M theory. But he says the same thing. Quantum fluctuations, multiple universes, bam. There we go. Out of nothing, nothing can come. Or out of nothing, something comes. Which we, ex nihilo nihil fit, we've always said in the West, you know, out of nothing, nothing comes. Well, math tells us something different. And I mentioned Krauss because he's received, this book has received really, really enthusiastic support from none other than Richard Dawkins. So actually, Dawkins gives the afterword to Krauss's book. Here's what he says. So we can read Lawrence Krauss for what looks to me, this is Dawkins, what looks to me like the knockout blow. Even the last remaining trump card of the theologian, why is there something rather than nothing, shrivels up before your eyes as you read these pages. If On the Origin of Species was biology's deadliest blow to supernaturalism, we may come to see a universe from nothing as the equivalent for cosmology. The title means exactly what it says, and what it says is devastating. Okay, so Richard Dawkins is going on record to say, look, here we have the cosmological equivalent of Origin of Species, and Dawkins has said in the past, you know, we can now be intellectually fulfilled atheists now that after Darwin. Before that, you couldn't be. You have to be like, how would you come up with all this? Well, he's putting this book on the same plane, and it's, again, it's a book about the most fundamental questions, and it's a mathematical answer. All right, so that's the case study. So that just shows right there that something's going on. Atheists are answering some of the most important, if not the most important, questions in philosophy using physics, which uses mathematics. And when I say physics, think, now there's a question even whether M theory and string theories are physical theories rather than just purely mathematical ones. So that's just the case study saying, look, there's a cultural issue here when it comes to mathematics. Now, what to do about it? You know, it's like, hey, go learn algebra better. That's not necessarily the answer. But I do want to at least give you some bit of evidence that these are crucial issues that we need to be paying attention to. And if you don't know what you're doing, you're not going to be able to address people like Hawking, Krauss, and Dawkins.